This episode contains graphic descriptions of crime scenes, which may be disturbing to some listeners.
Today, we're going to discuss a gruesome story, actually a series of stories, about the victims of a brutal murderer dating back to the 1950s and continuing into the 1980s. Most of these crimes were solved, but as you'll learn, one cold case remains. And while many of the victims, witnesses, and investigators of those crimes have passed on, we were able to speak with some of the original responding police officers, a key witness, and the author of a book about one of the most sadistic killers in upstate New York history.
This is APB Cold Case. Here's your host, former police chief Mark Spahn.
The first part of our story takes us back to 1977 in eastern New York State. We've changed the names of some of the victims in this story to protect their identities. On Friday, August 19th, Annette Russo was working in a Schenectady County law office. She was typically alone on Fridays when the attorney she worked for handled business outside the office. It was just another normal day for Annette, and after a long week, she was excited about a date she had planned for that night. At around 3 p.m. that afternoon, a parolee named Lemuel Smith entered the law office. Author Dennis Foley has done extensive research on Smith and his crimes. He said that Smith had been watching Annette for some time. Here's Dennis.
She was like 17 or 18, just a senior in high school. She was working part-time after school for an attorney. Lemuel Smith had, when he was on parole, she was delivering something to the courthouse, and he saw her in the elevator and followed her and then was stalking her. He used to stalk some of his victims. So he knew that on Friday afternoon, she was left alone at the office while the principal attorney went to do all his closings on Friday.
Dennis Foley is one of the few people who know the details of Smith's life and his victims. He's the author of the book Lemuel Smith and the Compulsion to Kill. As soon as Smith entered the office, he pulled out a gun and demanded money. Annette said that they didn't keep any money in the office. He then told her that she would have to drive him out of Schenectady County, and that if she cooperated, he'd let her go. When they reached her yellow Chevy Vega in the parking lot, Smith peered inside. The car appeared to have a stick shift, and since he was unable to drive a standard transmission, he pushed his young victim into the driver's seat and directed her to drive towards Saratoga. Annette was terrified for her life, but she followed his orders. She had no idea of the horror that was about to come. This was the beginning of Annette's traumatic 6.5-hour ordeal. From the law office, she was forced to drive to Lemuel Smith's parents' house in Saratoga, about 30 miles away. There, she was bound, beaten, and savagely raped. Smith made her clean up after the first rape, and after moving her to another room where she was again tied up, he viciously sodomized her. Lemuel Smith told her that he'd drop her off somewhere and let her go. But he knew he couldn't let her live, and he appeared to be very deliberate about where he would kill her and dump her body. Not wanting to do it anywhere near his parents' house, they returned to her car and headed back toward Albany, with Annette once again behind the wheel. Annette's parents were really worried, and their worry turned to panic. Their daughter was not home, and they knew that something was very, very wrong. It was extremely uncommon for Annette not to come straight home after work. They called the police to report her missing. Back in the 1970s, a call like this would not likely have elicited a quick police response for an 18-year-old who was late coming home from work. But Annette's father worked as a barber at the State Capitol building, and he knew some influential people. Schenectady police put out an alert for the missing girl and her car, the yellow Chevrolet Vega, along with her license plate number. Police also broadcast the information on the Citizens Band emergency channel. CB radios were extremely popular in the 70s, and many people had them in their homes and cars. Curtis Hakes, an employee of General Electric in Schenectady, heard the police broadcast of a missing girl on his recently purchased CB radio. He took note of the car description and the plate number. It was Hake's night off from the late shift at GE, and he and his pregnant wife were at home sharing a pizza. Hake's told us that he had a strong urge to go out and start looking for the vehicle. He thought he could help, and he felt compelled to do it. Here's Curtis Hake's.
I think it was about 11 o'clock or so is when he started to head towards Albany. I went over in that area behind the house and all the back streets and looked all around there first. I went down all the dead-end roads looking for the car. I had something to look for. It's not like you're looking something that looked out of place. You're looking for a car. It was really good to be able to have that information. As I'm driving, I'm saying, Lord, what's next? What do you want me to do when I get up to the stop sign? And I just sat there. There was no traffic. So I said, well, as long as there's no traffic, I think I'm going to just sit here. In 2 minutes, came the Yellow Vega. And then I pulled up behind him. And then pulled up close, got the license plate number, verified his license plate number, and then slipped back.
After Hakes miraculously spots the car, he calls it in on a CB radio. A relay operator called Colony Police, which dispatched officers to intercept. But at the time, the police didn't know who was in the car. Curtis Hakes followed the car until police arrived.
By the time they got down the road a little ways, they were able to get their car on my right-hand side, and I was able to back off and let the car in behind the Vega. I'm recalling all this, and I'm getting emotional.
Patrol officers John Griebert and Dave McCall spot the Yellow Vega, and they stop the car, finding the missing girl behind the wheel and a man in the passenger seat. The girl is visibly shaken. But unknown to police at the time, she'd been kidnapped and raped, and she was likely on her way to being murdered. Here's retired Colony Police Officer Dave McCall.
So I walked up to the car, and this girl, she had a look of terror and fear that I've never seen anybody's face. And, you know, red flags going up. Her eyes were watery. She was crying. I remember her chin was quivering like it was going a million miles an hour. When I walked up, I could see a passenger. I looked in, and there was this guy, my size. I'm like 6'3 by 250. And he was like my size, maybe a little bigger.
As Officer McCall approached the car, he noticed the man in the passenger seat had his hands beneath a towel in his lap.
Now, red flag's going off, boom, boom, boom. There's something wrong here. So I said to her, I want you out of the car. And I opened the door up. And it seemed like she leapt out of the car, like her feet didn't touch the ground, and a bear hugged me. And started screaming, I've been raped, he's got a gun, I've been raped. Hysterical.
Here's Officer John Griebert.
And I give her so much credit in the world because she, as upset as she was, and despite the ordeal that she went through, she was still managing to tell us to look out, he's got a gun.
Officer McCall drew his gun and ordered the man to put his hands on the dash.
Put your hands on the dash slowly. And he didn't move, he didn't flinch. He stared straight ahead. Like he didn't hear me or something. He had to, because I was yelling. I yelled again. I told him, put your hands on the fucking dash. Or you get shot. And he did. He put his hands on the dash. And we subsequently handcuffed him.
They placed the man in a police car and questioned him. He told officers that the girl was upset because it was a boyfriend-girlfriend argument, indicating that the girl's parents had an issue with him being black. But the police weren't buying it. Again, Officer Dave McCall.
I said to him, well, how have you been dating anyway? It's about a month or so. Okay, what's your last name? He just stared at me. I said, well, where does she live? Well, she picks me up, doing her parents don't say, a black guy. And I said, well, have you ever been arrested before? He said, yeah, for rape down in Maryland.
Here's Officer John Griebert.
There were some articles in the car. There were some robes and things that he had used to tie her up. And based on, you know, everything we had that night, we decided to bring everybody into the police station.
Officers Dave McCall and John Griebert were back at the station, but they had no idea who the suspect was. Here's Dave McCall.
I heard all this background noise, hear people talking. I couldn't make what they were saying. So I opened the door, peeked to see what was going on. I saw this brass from the state police, our bosses, Schenectady police, Albany police. I remember thinking to myself, I don't know what this guy's done, but he's in big trouble. These guys don't come out 2 o'clock on a Saturday morning just for something like this.
It's at this time that they discover the identity of their suspect. His name is Lemuel Smith. He was a suspect in several murders in the area. Police Officer John Griebert remembers the night.
We had no idea who Lemuel Smith was, what his known criminal history was. It's very extensive. It goes way back into the 1950s.
Again, here's former officer Dave McCall.
How eerily calm this guy was. You think he would stop for a parking ticket or something, how his demeanor. Nothing fazed him. He's pure evil. The guy has no conscience. He's just a real bad guy.
He was, you know, obviously the worst person, and from a criminal point of view, that was the most serious case that I was ever involved in. He was probably going to take her someplace, kill her, and dump the body. That's the thing. It's being in the right place at the right time, which, as anyone involved in law enforcement knows, a lot of times that's all that makes the difference between someone's life, you know, being saved and someone losing their life. So we felt good about it, but we probably didn't realize for some time after that night just how serious of a criminal Lemuel Smith was. And, you know, the fact that this woman who was probably doomed to a terrible death.
Officers Dave McCall and John Griebert are grateful that they were part of the chain of events that saved Annette Russo on that fateful night in 1977. And they know it would not have happened if not for the actions of Curtis Hakes and his CB radio. And the compassion for the young victim they helped to rescue is not lost decades later. Officer John Griebert.
Well, I think we just both hope that somehow the victim was able to recover and lead somewhat of a enjoyable, healthy life after what she had gone through. I'm sure that was not going to be easy.
This would be Lemuel Smith's last day of freedom. From that day in August 1977, he'd be behind bars. But that didn't mean that his murder streak was over. But first, we need to go back to the beginning. Lemuel Smith was born in 1941 in Amsterdam, New York. His father was a preacher. A psychiatrist testifying at one of Smith's trials said that Smith was overprotected, got fire and brimstone sermons from his minister father, and slept in the same bed with his mother until he was 12. He had a brother, John, who had died in infancy before Lemuel was born. And it would be this brother that Lemuel Smith would later claim was his alter ego, who was truly responsible for his crimes. Lemuel Smith, as it turned out, was a serial killer. He would be called evil, a monster, and as a judge described him, the poster child for the death penalty. But how did he become a violent and sadistic serial killer? We may never know the how or why, but we can take a look at his past. Let's go to 1958. Smith was 16 years old, living in Amsterdam, New York. On the evening of January 21, 1958, 46-year-old Dorothy Waterstreet, the treasurer of an adult Sunday school class, attended a church meeting a couple blocks from her home. The weather was bitter that night, with sleet, snow, and freezing rain. Dorothy and her husband Charles were well known in Amsterdam. He was a funeral director, and the family lived in the upper level of the funeral home just down the block from the Acme supermarket. Charles and Dorothy were both active in the community and church. At 10:35 p.m., Dorothy made the fateful decision to walk home from church, cutting through the Acme parking lot. In a dark corner of that parking lot, just steps from her home, she was savagely attacked and beaten severely about her head with some type of metal weapon. The blows were so brutal that her husband would not be able to identify her body. A pastor living nearby saw something laying in the parking lot and called police. There they found the deceased body of Dorothy Waterstreet. She still had cash in her pocket, and her purse was found across the street, also containing cash. So what was the motive? Was it robbery? Or something more sinister? During the police investigation, they noted a large shoe print near the victim's body and also in the area of the discarded purse. Police interviewed several people. One of those was Lemuel Smith, having been seen in the area by witnesses who lived nearby. Police collected his clothes and his size 13 shoes and noticed what appeared to be bloodstains. Lemuel explained that the stains were from an injury he received while playing basketball. Now, you have to remember that this is 1958. The evidence they had was purely circumstantial. And at that time, forensic blood testing was limited to ABO typing, which could only identify the characteristics like blood type AB or type O positive. DNA technology was decades away. They needed a strong witness, or better yet, a confession. One published report indicated that the DA was hasty in his interrogation of Lemuel and was unable to get a confession. I spoke with Dorothy Waterstreet's son, Charles. Charles shared with me that he attended school in Amsterdam. He and Lemuel Smith were classmates, and he remembers 6'1" Lemuel as a star center on the high school basketball team. That was until he became the prime suspect in the murder of Charles' mother, something well known in the community. Lemuel's parents were defensive and protective of their son, providing alibis and explanations about bloodstains on his clothing to police. But as the investigation became more focused, the classmate that Charles used to call Lem moved away. Lemuel Smith's parents sent him to Baltimore on July 6, 1958 to escape his troubles, but the 17-year-old brings trouble with him. On Wednesday, July 30, 1958, 25-year-old Edna Johnson was working alone at a Baltimore, Maryland dry cleaner's shop. That morning, Lemuel Smith walked in brandishing a knife and locking the door behind him. He forced the young woman into the back of the store and bound her hands and feet with a rope and belt before viciously beating her with an iron pipe. Reports indicate that the attack was interrupted by someone knocking on the front door of the store, and Lemuel fled. If not for that interruption, the assault would have continued, and Edna would likely have been killed. Edna suffered a fractured skull. She was unconscious for almost 2 weeks and would be hospitalized for 2 months. The police investigation began immediately, and within a few days, Lemuel Smith was charged with assault with intent to commit murder and robbery. The traumatized young woman who almost died identified Smith at trial, where he was found guilty and sentenced to 20 years. But Smith is paroled in 1968 at the age of 26. It's May of that year when he moves to the Schenectady area of New York State. Almost 1 year later, Emma Caruso was at the Schenectady Public Library. So a library is a nice, peaceful place, a place where you wouldn't expect any danger. But Emma didn't realize she was being watched. She leaves the library, goes to her car, and as she's opening the door, there's a man immediately on her. It's Lemuel Smith, and he's armed with a knife. He forces Emma into the car and orders her to drive to a nearby park. Emma is terrified. It's at this park where Smith begins to ruthlessly assault her. She fights back, and, fortunately, she's able to open the car door. She falls to the ground, catching the attention of a man who rushes to her aid. By the time police arrive, Lemuel Smith is long gone. Thankfully, Emma escaped, but Smith's crime spree was not over. That very same afternoon, he goes to the home of one of his mother's friends in Schenectady. He knocks at the door, and June Jackson answers. She recognizes Lemuel and welcomes him in. In an instant, Lemuel punches her in the face, breaking her nose. But his motive is rape, and knowing that she has a family who could return at any moment, he forces June to her car. Just like his victim earlier that day, Smith orders June to drive. This time, the destination is to his parents' house. The woman knew he was dangerous, and she feared for her life. So she hoped that if she played along, she might get out alive. Smith savagely raped her. He beat her and burned her arm with a cigarette. In the end, June was able to convince him to take her back home to Schenectady, where she promised she'd never tell anyone about what happened. But once she got home to safety, June and her husband called police, and Lemuel Smith was arrested. Smith pled guilty on November 11, 1969, sentenced to a term of 4 to 15 years in state prison for the attempted rape of Emma Caruso and the unlawful imprisonment of June Jackson. You might ask why the convictions were only for attempted rape and not rape, and for unlawful imprisonment instead of kidnapping. This sort of a plea bargain is not unusual, especially in sex crimes that would require that the victim first testify before a grand jury, then possibly at pretrial hearings, and then ultimately where they would have to tell and relive every dreadful detail of what's likely the worst incident of their lifetime. With a trial by judge or jury, the parties never know which way it'll go. A plea to a lesser charge, especially with the consent of the victim or the victim's family, allows for a measure of certainty of conviction, while the defendant accepts some degree of responsibility. About 7 years later, October 1976, now 35-year-old Lemuel Smith is once again paroled. On November 24, 1976, the day before Thanksgiving, 59-year-old Margaret Byron was working at Hederman's Religious Store in downtown Albany. Bob Hederman was the owner who was out running errands when Lemuel Smith, wearing religious vestments, came into the store. Margaret Byron never stood a chance. Albany police get a call to respond to Hederman's Religious Store to investigate a suspicious circumstance. The store seems to be open for business, but no employees can be found. Michael DeMarco was one of the responding officers back in 1976.
We didn't know if anybody was in the building with us or what. So, you know, we started to search aggressively. And then as we searched, we came across the Hederman body. He was in the bathroom, and he was laying on the floor, and his throat was slit. And he was a big guy. I mean, he was a big guy. And he fell down, and his body went around the toilet. So at that point, we called for a supervisor, and we called for investigators.
The first body they find is 48-year-old Bob Hederman. He was still wearing his overcoat, and his throat had been slit to his spine. Police continue to search the building.
Anybody here, you know? And no one answered. So at that point, we started to proceed towards the back of the retail portion of the store, and it was like a storage area. So as we walked in, we looked down, we see this woman on a floor, you know?
Next, they found the body of Margaret Byron in a rear storeroom. She had been mercilessly stabbed more than 50 times, and she had bruising around her throat. It appeared as if Bob had interrupted the intruder who had killed Margaret, and then Bob himself was murdered in cold blood. Evidence left behind at the scene included blood and feces-stained religious clothing. The store that catered to the religious community had become a crime scene of ruthless inhumanity. Police had no idea who the killer was at the time, but Officer DeMarco felt the evil.
He was a monster. He was a monster for what he did. I mean, these were older people. These weren't young people. He just murdered them. It was right before Thanksgiving. Of course, you know, the holiday came, and it's on your mind. The guy was an animal.
As the rest of the world was getting ready for the Christmas holiday, police were working hard to solve the Hederman Religious Store murders. Detectives were steadily making progress, following up on leads, interviewing potential suspects, and combing the area for witnesses. While police are investigating these violent crimes, Lemuel Smith is still on the loose. On December 23rd that same year, 24-year-old Joan Richburg went Christmas shopping at the busy Colony Center Mall just outside of Albany. She parked her car in a remote section of the mall parking lot between two large snowplow trucks. As she shopped inside, she didn't notice that she was being followed. A light snow was falling that night. As Joan was getting into her green Ford Mustang, a man crept up from behind. He was on her in an instant. He had a knife, and he forced the terrified girl into her car. He struck her violently on the right side of her chin and her nose, which began to bleed. Inside that car, sandwiched between those two large trucks, Lemuel Smith continued his brutal assault on a defenseless Joan. He bound her and raped her. Smith ultimately forced a scarf down her throat, causing her to choke and die. Before he left, Smith sadistically mutilated her breasts and genitals. Joan's bloodied body wasn't discovered until the next day when the owners of the snowplows came back to check on their vehicles. When they looked inside the Mustang, they saw a girl laying between the bucket seats, her throat obviously slashed. They immediately called police. Joan's family and friends were left devastated by her senseless murder. Police assembled a task force to investigate the horrific crime wave. Could the murder of Joan Richburg in the mall parking lot be connected with the double murders at Hederman's Religious Store? Investigators worked aggressively, chasing every lead, searching for possible witnesses, and checking parolees who might have an MO similar to the murders. One of those parolees, Lemuel Smith, was picked up for questioning. Smith had an alibi for the time in question. Investigators needed to verify his claims, but they certainly didn't take him off their list of possibles. It was now January 10th, 1977, more than a month since the double murder at Hederman's Religious Store in Albany, and just a few weeks after the murder of Joan Richburg at the Colony Center Mall. The region was in the midst of the season's largest snowstorm when Lemuel Smith set his sights on a gift shop in Albany. He had already cased the shop earlier, assuming that there would be an older woman, Mabel, and a younger woman, Leanne, working that day. Once inside the store, Smith roused the suspicion of Leanne when he acted as if he was having a problem with the door latch. The cautious Leanne called to her grandmother, who came out. And that's when Smith grabbed Mabel, pointing a gun to her head. Leanne ran to another room with Smith in pursuit. She locked the door behind her as he kept coaxing her to come out, but she refused. An enraged Smith knocked the elder Mabel unconscious while Leanne's screams for help were gathering attention from next door. As Smith ran from the store, he callously stomped on Mabel's hand, breaking it. They called police, who began an investigation. After looking through hundreds of mugshots at the police station, neither of the women were able to identify the suspect. But months later, when Lemuel Smith would make headlines, the grandmother and granddaughter would see his picture and identify him as their attacker. 7 months passed since the last known violent crime that will later be connected to Lemuel Smith. Around 5:15 on Friday, July 22, 1977, Merrill Lee Wilson left her job as a legal secretary in Schenectady, New York. She was last seen in the parking lot outside her office. That night, Merrill Lee's bloody, naked body is found face down in the dirt by two women walking along the railroad tracks near her office. Police are called, and the investigation begins. When the body was being removed for the coroner, investigators saw that tree branches had been inserted deeply into Merrill Lee's vagina, anus, and mouth. Police suspect that her hands had been bound, and they noticed injuries to her face, neck, and breast. Knowing that many homicides are committed by people with some type of a connection to the victim, police begin looking into Merrill Lee's past and present relationships. During that investigation, an alert police officer told detectives that he had seen parolee Lemuel Smith in the area shortly after 3 p.m. on that same Friday when Merrill Lee's body was found. The police officer made it a point to know all of the parolees on his beat. Another one of the dots in the story was connected when a witness reported an altercation between Merrill Lee Wilson and a man who would later be identified as Lemuel Smith in February, 4 months before the murder. Other witnesses reported a man matching Smith's description watching girls around the office buildings in the city. Even Lemuel's own brother-in-law approached police, saying that he thought Lemuel could be responsible for the vicious killing. Schenectady police now focused on Lemuel Smith as their main suspect. It's now summer 1977, and police have been investigating the series of horrific crimes in the region, starting with first, the Hederman Religious Store murders in November 1976. Second, the rape and murder of Joan Richburg in December 1976. Third, the assault of Mabel and Leanne in the Albany gift shop in January 1977. And fourth, the Merrill Lee Wilson murder in July 1977. And that brings us back to where our story began, with a brutal rape and abduction of 18-year-old Annette Russo on August 19, 1977. We now know why the police station was filled with investigators from several different agencies when Lemuel Smith was brought in. Once again, here's retired police detective Dave McCall describing Lemuel Smith's emotionless personality.
How eerily calm this guy was. Nothing fazed him. He's pure evil.
The pieces of this large puzzle were coming together. Physical evidence, witnesses, and the M.O. Abduction, violent assaults with a weapon, rape, sodomy, sexual mutilation, and murder. All signs pointed to a clear suspect, and with the help of a concerned citizen and his CB radio, two Colony police officers had just stopped the Albany area's public enemy number one. You'll remember that among the items of evidence found at the double murder at the Hederman Religious Store were some religious vestments covered with feces. Even though Bob Hederman and Margaret Byron could not speak for themselves, police hoped that perhaps a trained canine could make an identification of their killer. They went to Bleecker Stadium in Albany, where police had constructed 5 plywood barriers. Behind each separated barrier was a man. One of those men was Lemuel Smith. A bloodhound smelled the feces-contaminated garments found at the scene and then set out across the football field, where the five men were hidden behind their individual partitions. On the very first attempt, the dog alerted to the partition where Lemuel Smith was standing. The test was conducted two more times, each time changing the position of the men. Again and again, the dog alerted to Lemuel Smith. Here's author Dennis Foley.
Albany police did a beautiful job. The dog sniffed the defecation and then went over to Smith.
Police were building their case. They found a witness who happened by Hederman's religious store right after the murder, the witness describing a wild-eyed black male, about 6 feet tall, standing near the body of Margaret Byron. Another witness described seeing a black man leaving Hederman's store at the approximate time of the killings. When she was shown a photo lineup, she picked out Lemuel Smith. Albany police searched Smith's locker at his place of work, finding one of his sweaters with a human hair on it, which would later be identified by the FBI lab as being consistent with the hair of Margaret Byron. Lemuel Smith was convicted of kidnapping, rape, and robbery for the case involving victim Annette Russo. He was also found guilty of the murders of Robert Hederman and Margaret Byron at their religious store. For the murders, he was sentenced to two life sentences. Additional murder charges for victims Joan Richburg and Marilee Wilson were dismissed, not because of concerns over lack of evidence or witnesses, but out of consideration that Lemuel Smith had no chance of release. Holding two more trials with no chance of an additional penalty seemed like a futile pursuit to prosecutors. Lemuel Smith was now a sentenced prisoner of the state and was sent to Greenhaven Correctional Facility in Dutchess County, New York, about 70 miles north of New York City. With the sadistic and brutal killer now behind bars, people in the greater Albany area of New York State were likely breathing a sigh of relief, knowing that they were safe from the man who was single-handedly responsible for a reign of terror. Except, it wasn't over yet. It was May 15, 1981, when police believed that Smith killed prison guard Donna Payant in the prison chaplain's office. When she was a no-show at the end of her workday, an extensive search began. The following day, her mutilated and badly bitten body was discovered at a county landfill where prison garbage was routinely taken. State police came in to do the investigation, and they immediately requested from prison officials a list of inmates convicted of murder and sex crimes. The list included more than 600 names. Then, police started piecing together the bite marks from Payant's body and Lemuel Smith's M.O. with the mutilation and biting of previous victims. They knew that Smith worked in the chaplain's office, where police believed the prison guard had been killed, and that part of Smith's duties included transporting garbage bags to the loading dock. The autopsy revealed a gruesome attack. The official cause of death was strangulation with a cord from a set of Venetian blinds in the chaplain's office, but Donna had suffered trauma to her head. Her nipples had been bitten off, and a foreign object, possibly a mop handle, had been forced into her anus. The investigation pointed to one man, Lemuel Smith. He was charged with murder. Under the law at the time, the murder of a corrections officer was a capital offense. Smith went to trial and was convicted. He was sentenced to death in June 1983, but it would be his case on appeal that resulted in the death of New York State's death penalty law. The state's highest court found the law unconstitutional. Smith's sentence was commuted to another life sentence. At the time of this production, Lemuel Smith is still incarcerated at Wendy Correctional Facility in Alden, New York. He's 82 years old. All told, five brutal murders have been attributed to Lemuel Smith from 1976 to 1981, along with other sexual assaults, kidnapping, and robbery. But what about the January 1958 case of Dorothy Waterstreet we talked about earlier, when Lemuel Smith was a teenager in high school in Amsterdam, New York? Some reports say that he confessed to the murder, including a psychiatrist who testified at one of Lemuel Smith's trials that he admitted to killing Dorothy Waterstreet. And despite having other circumstantial evidence that aligns with Lemuel Smith, he was never indicted for her murder. Another published report indicated that the overzealous DA botched the case, with his wanting to conduct the interrogation of the suspect himself. And author Dennis Foley, who spent countless hours interviewing Lemuel Smith behind bars, is also convinced that Smith is the killer of Dorothy Waterstreet in 1958. Here's Dennis Foley.
He killed Dorothy Waterstreet. He did confess that crime to a state police detective or BCI fellow, Dorothy Waterstreet had driven Lemuel Smith to events because he needed a car. He lived right around the corner, and he was very close friends with her son, Skip. They went to the same high school in the same year. So he killed his friend's mother.
Dorothy's other son, Charles, who grew up and attended school with Smith, told me that he never saw his tormented side, but he's convinced that Lemuel is the man who killed his mother. For all of Lemuel Smith's crimes that we know of, all have some sort of disposition, by conviction or dismissal of the indictments based on no additional penalty. But the one cold case that appears to have never been presented to a grand jury is the murder of Dorothy Waterstreet. Lemuel Smith is eligible for parole in 2029. He'll be 87 years old at that time. When he was sentenced in 1976, everyone probably thought that his multiple life sentences would take him to the end of his life. But that parole date is now just a few years away. And even though he spent most of his life in prisons, some feel that if he made parole, he'd still be a danger to society. Here's Dennis Foley.
And I would still think he could be a risk. I really believe that he's a case study on evil. And I think one of the characteristics is they accept no responsibility and they have no remorse. And whatever they do is all right. And he was definitely evil.
We'll be keeping an eye on the parole status of Lemuel Smith. For source material and additional information, check out our show notes at apbcoldcase.com.
Thanks for listening to APB Cold Case. Tell us about your cold case at apbcoldcase@spawngroup.com.